for Northeast Dublin. 90.3. Near FM.
George Bernard Shaw said, political necessities sometimes turn out to be political mistakes. Good afternoon. You're very welcome to International Politics Near 90.3 FM's look at the world of international politics and national politics of international significance. I'm Peter Kearney and I'm with you fortnightly every Tuesday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. Significant happenings on this day on the 26th of February. In 1850, Napoleon Bonaparte escapes from Elba. 1935, Hitler orders the Luftwaffe be reformed, violating the Versailles Treaty. And in 1980, Egypt and Israel establish full diplomatic relations. Significant birthdays on this day, the 26th of February. Well, I could only find one significant one of political significance, that is, and that was Ariel Sharon, the 11th Prime Minister of Israel, born on this day in 1928. And in this fortnight's International Politics show, we've got a lot of stuff lined up for you, so we're going to get straight into it. The first one up is the Shell to Sea campaign. We haven't heard much from that in the mainstream media or any form of media for a while, so we're going to be talking to Terence Conway. It's a recording I did with Terence last night about what has been happening in the campaign, court cases and so on and so forth. It's Israel Apartheid Week at the moment. As you know, I'm going to be talking to Dr. David Landy of the Irish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. A pre-record I did at the Battle for Afghanistan talk given by William Dalrymple at the Royal Irish Academy the other week. I'm going to have a short little piece with him just before 4 o'clock. And then our special feature this week, it's Armenia. So after the break, I'm going to be speaking to the wife of one of the presidential candidates in the recent Armenian elections, that is Andreas Gerkassian. Speaking to his wife, as Andreas was on hunger strike and he was too weak to take the interview. And as well as that, there's going to be an interview with an Ara Gazarian, who is a human rights lawyer in Armenia and is going to be talking to us about the life of a journalist in Armenia and how easy and difficult it might be. If you want to participate in the show, you can, by as always, by texting us on 087 6944 500. That's 087 6944 500. Email me peter.carney2@gmail.com. Or you can ring us directly at the station here, 867 1190. That's 867 1190. And if you want to follow me on Facebook and Twitter, just go in there, or in the group Meetup, go into International Politics or Peter's Politics, International Politics Dublin, and you'll find us right there. Okay, so as I was saying, first up is the Shell to Sea campaign. And as you may remember, it goes back almost as far as October 1996. In fact, probably even further than that, when Enterprise Oil discovered the Carib gas field 80 kilometres off the northwest coast of Mayo. And since that time, and since planning permission was granted and planning permission was blocked, there's been a series of protests. We've had appeals, we've had court cases, we've had imprisonments, we've had hunger strikes, and the protests continue to this day. Well, one of the most recent chapters in the event was on Wednesday the 13th of February, just gone, in Belmullet District Court. Shell to Sea campaigner Izzy Nugratham was convicted of public order offences, so she refused to do community service as a result of that, as she felt that she was doing the community a service by protesting the siege from Shell. The judge then sentenced Miss Nugratham to 3 months in jail. Well, somewhat surprisingly, Izzy was let out last Friday, only about 10 days into the sentence, and that meant that the protest planned for outside Mountjoy Prison last Saturday was cancelled. Since that time, I spoke to Shell to Sea campaigner Terence Conway to find out more about the campaign and what exactly is happening at the moment in Northwest Mayo. What did she do that led her to be sentenced to 3 months in prison?
She went up on top of a digger to stop it from working. The digger was in the process of bringing a water mains to Shell site in Leenamore. Right. And she prevented it from working for a few hours.
Now, she was released after 10 or so days. Was there any indication as to why she was released?
They just came into the cell and told her that she was pack her stuff, she was being let go. They told her that she'd have to sign on in Belmullet Garda Station every day until the first of next month, and once a week after that.
Now, the Shell to Sea campaign and the Rossport support campaign is something that a lot of people know about. In recent weeks and months, there hasn't been a huge amount of publicity in the mainstream media, at least. Can you tell us what exactly has been happening up there?
Well, on an ongoing basis, we have been stopping trucks coming and going to Shell sites. Just slowing what it's doing primarily is slowing them down, which is part of what we have done from the very beginning. The Rossport 5, when they were sent to jail for obstructing Shell from going on their land. So the same methods have continued on to this day. But what we've been doing as well is collecting information, and we recently, Dublin Shell to Sea recently had a launch of liquid assets, letting people know exactly what was involved with the oil and gas, what the oil company figures are for what's around our coast. That was a long process, researching that.
Now, what exactly did they find?
Well, according to oil company estimates, there's 1.6 trillion worth of oil and gas off the coast, around about the coast, and some inland. This is, according to them, it's not all recoverable, but there would be a large portion of it that could be recovered. So when you consider, in the present climate, where the country has gone down the tubes, as they say, the government are trying to cut back on everything, cut back on services. On the one hand, they're doing that to the citizens, and at the same time, they have made the conscious decision that the citizens of Ireland cannot have their own oil and gas. They're being used purely for the benefit of the oil companies.
Okay. Now, just to get back to the campaign itself, the Shell to Sea campaign, Izzy Newgratham was released from prison, as we know, last Friday. Other members of the campaign are going to be up in court as well, and I believe yourself, Terence, you're one of those people.
Correct. I'm up in court in Belmullet.
And what is that in relation to?
I was parked along the side of the road in obstruction. My car parked along the side of the road. There was maybe 2 foot of it out on the public road, as you'll see in any part of the country, the countryside. Still plenty of room for cars to go by, cars, trucks, tractors, and a guard has seen it and took down the numbers, the car or whatever, and he I was just parked there for about a minute or two, so I was walking out back out the car when he was there. When he came there, he told me I was causing obstruction. I said, it's the way everybody parks around here, they're going into a field.
Yes.
So it went on from there, and he gave me a... He took my number. I was sent whatever it was in the post, a fixed penalty thing. I had a certain number of days to pay it. I didn't pay it. It doubled at that stage or whatever. I didn't pay that. Then I got a summons.
Right. So as a result of you parking your car incorrectly, you're up in court for that. Now, as you said, it's something that people do all over the country. Quite possibly it's something, and indeed not quite possibly, it's something people shouldn't do. However, it's hardly an offence worthy of taking up the court's time or anything else of that nature. Is there any reason, can you think of any reason as to why you were singled out, firstly for this fine and then for the treatment afterwards?
It's purely and simply harassment. Like the Gardaí, I have plenty of evidence of the Gardaí harassing me when I'm driving my vehicle, stopping me, telling me that neither me or my car is allowed to go wherever I want to go.
Does that happen on a regular basis, Terence?
On a very regular basis. Okay. That's the reason I did not pay it.
Right, and you now, believe that's as a result of your connection with the Shell to Sea campaign?
Oh, it absolutely is.
Okay.
Because while on the one hand the Gardaí are doing this sort of harassment to me and others and numerous other people around the area, at the same time Shell Security can drive without tax or insurance displayed.
Really?
That I have very clearly on video.
And has that been brought to people's attention?
It has, but... The Gardaí seen it, they dragged people out of the way and assaulted people to make sure and waved the security van on.
Okay. Now, in your opinion and your observations and your involvement in the campaign, have you seen, maybe in connection to the
example you've just given us, have you seen some kind of a, I don't know, there's a greater amount of cooperation between the guards and Shell than there is between the guards and, say, yourselves as normal citizens?
In this area, the Gardaí operate as if they were Shell workers, as if they were employed directly by Shell.
Right. Okay.
That is a fact. That's the way they operate daily.
Okay, okay. Now, in some of your press releases here, I've got a list of different rumours that you've listed here about the different projects that they're involved in, and it talks about the Ahus.
Yeah.
Rumours abound that the TBM is stuck in the Doab. It's a mysterious clay-like substance underlying much of the blanket bog in the area. It's well known and understood locally, but Shell are getting stuck in it. Can you elaborate on that for us? First, if you can just tell us what the TBM is and then the Doab as well.
TBM is a tunnel boring machine where they plan to tunnel under Shawadacon Bay.
Uh-huh.
It's about 500 tonnes in weight, and they basically drill a tunnel through the bay, underneath the bay. But the problem is the type of ground they're going through. It's totally unsuitable for a tunnel. It's bordering on total stupidity, actually, to try to put a tunnel in there.
Mm.
Because of the nature of the underlying ground, it's there's an incredible amount of dope, which is a sort of a semi-liquid, a subsoil and water.
Right.
I heard from one of the engineers, the German engineers that were there to work on the job. He stated that it's like taking one step forward and three steps back. They understand that it may turn out to be not viable.
Now, in terms of the overall project that they have in mind for the area, where are they in relation to that? Is it near completion, or are they a long way off? Or
they're on the last stages of it.
Okay. Where is your campaign at the moment?
Our campaign is at present carries on the same as ever.
Yeah.
Slowing down Shell as we can, getting information out there to the people. Our campaign continues on.
Right.
And the effect it's had on Shell and partners is it has almost quadrupled the cost of the project. There will be further delays and there will be further costs.
Right. And is your campaign going to continue indefinitely?
For as long as it takes.
As long as it takes, okay. And your ultimate goal is?
Shell out. They've shown contempt for the area. They've shown contempt for everybody in the area by polluting the local drinking water during construction of the refinery. Since then, they've tried to improve their image with a few grants, a couple of euros here and there to GEA, clubs and whatever. As far as we're concerned, that's bribery.
Yeah.
And bribery does not work. Mm-hmm. Right, they can buy some, but some of us are not for sale.
Now, in its ninth year, Israeli Apartheid Week is an annual international series of events held in cities and campuses across the globe. Last year was incredibly successful, with over 215 cities taking part. Israel Apartheid Week, IAW, aims to raise awareness about Israel's apartheid policies towards Palestinians and to build support for the growing campaign of boycott, divestment and sanctions, otherwise known as BDS, against Israel. This year, the Ireland-Palestinian Solidarity Campaign is proud to be hosting a series of events in Ireland. Now, I'm joined on the line by Dr. David Landy of the Irish-Palestinian Solidarity Campaign to tell us a little bit more. Good afternoon to you, David Landy.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, good, thanks. Now, the week itself, why do you call Israel an apartheid state?
I think the reason we call Israel an apartheid state, and the reason that actually this week is held in the first place, is because when people do think of Israel-Palestine, they think of it in terms of the conflict, such as the assault on Gaza last November, which killed over 150. Mm. What we want to focus on is the everyday system of oppression and racism that obtains in Israel-Palestine, not simply during Israel Apartheid Week, not simply when there's conflict, but all the time. And the reason then we call Israel an apartheid state is because, really, if you look at, for instance, the International Criminal Court's definition of what apartheid is from about 10 years ago, they talk about it as an institutionalized regime of systemic oppression and domination by one racial group over another. Mm. And acts, inhumane acts, committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. So apartheid isn't simply something that happened in South Africa 20 years ago. It's actually happening in other places in the world. And one of the places it's happening in, very much so, and unfortunately with the connivance of the EU, is in Israel-Palestine.
Right. Now, why do you think, for example, the apartheid state of Israel doesn't seem to have the same, shall we put it, ring to it around the world as, say, the apartheid state of South Africa did?
Well, I suppose around 1970, people, a lot of people didn't see anything particularly wrong with what was happening in South Africa.
Right.
And it was only with the global campaign, the anti-apartheid campaign, that people were saying, actually, firstly, there's something wrong with it, and secondly, we can actually do something about it, which, as you say before, is the campaign of boycott, divestment, sanctions. Yeah. One of the reasons that people don't see Israel as an apartheid, as a racist state, is, I say, this framing of it as simply a violent situation of conflict between two equal groups. Whereas, in actual fact, if you look at what's going on there, what really strikes you, whether we're talking about the occupied territories, the West Bank and Gaza, or we're talking about the way Palestinians are treated within Israel itself, because 20% of the population of Israel itself is Palestinian. Mm. Over half of the population of the Israel-Palestine is non-Jewish.
Right.
So if you look at that, it is a system of continual racist domination, right, and oppression of these people.
Yeah. Now, is IAW, Israel Apartheid Week, is that for you inextricably linked to BDS campaign, to the boycott, divestment and sanctions of Israel?
Very much so, because what we want to do in Israel Apartheid Week is in a way twofold.
Mm.
Firstly, what we want to do is education, that we actually want to tell people about, as I say, the everydayness of what goes on and what, like, Palestinian people have to endure.
Yeah.
And so today, for instance, we were had a launch of a report by Stephen McCluskey from the Center for Global Education, where he was talking about the situation for children in Gaza, and it was a very distressing report,
mm-hmm,
where he's talking about, like, drinking water being undrinkable, 60% of the kids in Gaza are suffering from anemia because fresh fruit isn't allowed in. And it's this level of everydayness that we actually want to highlight. So that's the first thing, just to talk about actually what is going on in the area. And the second thing is to say, well, what can we do about it?
Yeah. Now, BDS, it is very well known in Ireland, and particularly among the Irish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. And I'm assuming that the ultimate goal of it is to achieve justice for Palestinians. Now, it doesn't, at the same time, have worldwide support. It has come in from some criticism from some of the heavyweights on this topic, people like Chomsky and Finkelstein. What would you say about their, I mean, I'm not asking you to comment on them, but if there's opposition from people of their calibre, what does that do to the BDS campaign?
Yeah, the BDS campaign is, I'd be a bit more positive about actually the support it has.
Right.
Because I remember when it first came in, which was about 7 years ago, when it first started, the BDS campaign, and many people were saying, you know, this probably isn't the way forward.
Mm.
Whereas nowadays, it's become much more popular. I mean, if we take Norman Finkelstein, who's a person who I have a huge amount of respect for, his argument isn't actually against BDS. His argument is about, he's not against boycott, divestment, sanctions. His argument is against, like, some of the tactical things that the campaign makes.
Right.
And I think this is a conversation well worth having.
Yes.
But generally speaking, what we've seen over the last 7 years is a huge growth in the support for BDS. I mean, it's still not big enough, but
yes, it's definitely growing.
It is growing. And one of the interesting things is within Israel itself, the support for BDS is growing as many Israelis, as white South Africans before them, realize this is the way to put pressure on the Israeli government to achieve peaceful change.
Okay. Now, David, there's a number of events have already taken place for Israel Apartheid Week. Can you tell us what's left for the rest of the week?
Surely, I'd be happy to. One of the education events, I'll just talk about Dublin.
Sure.
The launch of the report about children in Gaza has already happened, but you can read that report up on our website.
Right.
Another event, education event, that we're having is on Saturday, and we're having a Palestine Film Day.
Oh, I can't wait for that. I'm down for that. Yeah.
Great stuff. Yeah. It starts at 2 o'clock. It's in the Pier Centre on Pier Street, and it's a series of documentaries about Palestine, but also at 3:30 we're having a documentary called Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies People. Yeah. Because we want to actually talk about this issue of racism, not simply within Israel, but also more generally. So yeah, please people, do check our website to see what's on there.
Okay.
But besides that, as I say, one of the things we're doing is in relation to actions. We already have had a boycott day of action in Dublin, and on Thursday lunchtime at 1 o'clock we're going to be outside the EU office to demonstrate opposition to what we see as European support for Israeli apartheid.
Okay, fantastic stuff. Where can people get more information on it?
They can get information on our website, which is www.ipsc.ie.
And put in Israel Apartheid Week there. That's fantastic. Dr. David Landy from the Irish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Britain's first invasion of Afghanistan in 1839 bore marked resemblance to the war currently being waged there by the British, the Americans and indeed so many others. Then, as now, the conflict was based on doctored intelligence and virtually non-existent threat. Getting into Afghanistan was relatively easy, but the occupation provoked a fierce resistance that made getting out problematic. The same tribal rivalries and stupidities afflicted the campaign. When the present British forces withdraw, David Cameron will undoubtedly proclaim victory, as the Governor-General did in 1842. Now, this is all according to William Dalrymple, who's quite an expert on the subject, having visited there many times and written a book on the area, The Battle for Afghanistan. I caught up with him the other week, on the 13th of February, in fact, when he was in Dublin to give a talk about the contents of the book and about the similarities between the British invasion of Afghanistan in the 1840s and the present day invasion of British and American and other forces in Afghanistan, the differences and indeed the great similarities that exist between the two conflicts. Well, you gave a fascinating talk here this evening in the Royal Irish Academy on the battle for Afghanistan. To get straight to the point, you talked about a lot this evening. What parallels do you see between what you've covered in the book and the talk tonight and what's happening in Afghanistan today?
Well, I certainly have never come across any example in my reading of history where history replays itself more exactly.
Mm.
I mean, in a very general way, the trajectory of the whole Western intervention in Afghanistan after 9/11 follows a very similar trajectory to the 1840 war. There's an easy conquest, a period of sort of peace and harmony, a slowly growing insurgency, and then it's a growing catastrophe when the Western forces find themselves surrounded in the cities with an entirely hostile countryside around them, followed by a humiliating exit. But by the micro detail also is parallel. Shah Shuja, the guy the British put in 1839, is the same sub-tribe as President Karzai.
Yeah.
The people who brought him down, the Gilzai, now the foot soldiers of the Taliban. So in terms of the kind of ethnic, the political geography of the insurgency, it's the same war fought with slightly different flags and a slightly different spin. And then when you even go to the kind of tiny micro details of individual cities, you go to Kandahar, the boundary of the Argandab River was the boundary in 1840 between the British and the insurgents, and today is the boundary between ISAF and Taliban. And you read reports from diaries of people, of British troops going down over the bridge and fighting the Durrani cavalry. Today, I saw on the same boundary, you know, an American convoy of Humvees go down and be blown up by an IED on the same spot. Mm. So while there are important differences, Karzai's a Democrat, he's more popular, the Taliban is more fractured, and Mullah Omar is a less dominating figure than Wazir Akbar Khan was in 1840. There are these differences, but overall it's an extraordinary replay of history, and in many places exactly so.
Now, you've been to Afghanistan yourself and you've seen the terrain. Surely would it not be obvious that it's a difficult place to conquer and then a difficult place to hold?
You'd have thought someone might have made this point, but it seems that, you know, despite a Foreign Office full of brilliant Oxbridge-educated people with brilliant verse they don't tell the politicians this when they need to hear it. And Tony Blair was, a fantastically ignorant, historically illiterate man, and walked in and performed the same mistakes as all his predecessors.
And what's the blind side? I mean, particularly
what's the plus side? Yeah.
How are they not seeing this? Particularly the British.
Well, don't ask me. I can see.
They're not getting the message.
Ask them.
They're not asking the message. Yeah, they keep getting drawn in.
Yeah, they do. Each time they think they can walk in, do regime change, and be out in 6 months, and of course each other in for 10 years, and basically they're fucked. It's all.
That's the end. And in the meantime, the Afghans are suffering as a result of all these people wanting.
Each time
a piece
the Afghans, are up to maybe, obviously there are deaths on all sides, and there are many tragic cases of innocent British 16-year-olds who sign up for the army and find themselves in some remote posting, get shot, and their family receive a body back home, and no one likes that. But yeah, ultimately it's the Afghans who take the take the ultimate
Price. The talk that was given afterwards, it was mentioned that despite all of these comings and goings across Afghanistan, whenever Afghans have been left to themselves, they manage quite well, and of late people.
Well, Afghan history, like anywhere else in the world, has its good points and its bad points. But no, there's 100 years between about 1870 and 1970 when it's a perfectly sensible United Nation with it's fractured and it's very, very poor, and it is one of the poorest countries in the world, and it's up there with Mauritania and Eritrea and Bangladesh for one of the least developed regions historically. But nonetheless, it is a peaceful country, and it has just had this desperate history since 1979.
So we need not worry necessarily for their safety should the Americans and all the rest of them leave.
No, I think we should worry, because I think there's no question that the most likely outcome in the next few years is more years of civil war and bloodshed. And no, I mean, it's not impossible that things could work out, but it's extremely unlikely that it'll be anything other than a period of conflict and civil war ahead of us.
And you mentioned, or was mentioned at the end of the talk, that the Chinese might be the next. In fact, they are already doing it, except they're not going in with an army. They're going in with their business people.
Clever. They just bought everything up. And the Afghans always have to do business.
Right.
They don't mind at all doing business with anyone, but they won't be invaded, and they won't be dominated by an occupying force, and they'll fight until they're free again. And the Chinese seem to recognise this, and they've just turned up with large suitcases full of dollar bills and bought up the mineral rights.
Okay. Good.
They bought the rare earth, they bought the copper, and they'll be laughing over the next century when we have to buy our iPads out of China.
Absolutely. And you've written quite a lot about the history. Now, if you were to project forward into the future for Afghanistan, apart from the imminent civil wars and civil unrest in the Chinese,
so in the long term, there's no reason Afghanistan can't prosper as a nation like anywhere else, and given a fair wind, it will do. But the short term prognosis is not optimistic. No, I think you'd be very foolish to put your money on a peaceful Afghanistan over the next 5 years. In the long term, it's got minerals, it's got a amazing country. It could be the Switzerland of Central Asia in particular.
Podcasting 24 hours a day at nearpodcast.org.
Join me, Conny O'Reilly, every Wednesday afternoon at 2:30 for Music and Musings.
Schlaft pieces.
I shall be playing operatic, light classical, and old world. And in between, we shall be musing on some of the noteworthy events of the day. So don't forget, Music and Musings with me, Conny O'Reilly, every Wednesday at 2:30.
Marty was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner.
Reaching from behind him, Akira felt for an orchid that he had laid upon the ground. Finding it, he placed it in his hands and rolled it vigorously between his palms until
the egg yolks gradually beating all the time. Stir in some almonds and whisk the egg whites until stiff.
Listen to Cover every second Friday from 3:30 to 4:30 here on Near FM.
If you like your music with an alternative feel, tune in to the Neon Room here on Near FM. With myself, Dave Rigney, I'll be paying you the very best in rock, funk, jazz, electronica, and a whole lot more. That's the Neon Room, Thursdays at 10 p.m. here on Near FM.
Contemporary Capitalism on Near FM every Thursday this February from the 7th to the 28th and from 3:30 to 4 is a four-part series of lectures critiquing how capitalism and profit-making operate in the modern Western world and the effect they have on people's lives. That's Contemporary Capitalism every Thursday this February from 3:30 to 4 on Near FM.
Sure, Radio Pubal Tushkert, Balia Oha Clia.
Your community station,
Near FM.
And you're welcome back to International Politics with me, Peter Carney. And if you want to participate in the show, you can do so as always by texting us on 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. Or call the station on 867-1190. You can find me on Facebook or Twitter or indeed the Meetup group. Put in International Politics Dublin or Peter's Politics and you'll find me right there. Okay, so this is our special feature of the week, of the fortnight, and it's Armenia. And firstly, we go to the presidential elections, because the presidential elections were held there on the 18th of February. And in that campaign, anti-corruption presidential candidate Andrius Gokassian continued his hunger strike afterwards up until the 20th of February, 2 days after the presidential elections. The 43-year-old camped out in front of the Armenian National Academy of Sciences in the capital city of Yerevan. He sat there between two large posters, one in Armenian, one in English, saying, "Stop fake elections." He believed, and the purpose of his campaign was, and the purpose of his hunger strike was, that he believed the Armenian president, who was again running for election, Armenian President Serge Sarkisian, he believed that him and his government were corrupt. It was amidst allegations of corruption and street protests that President Serge Sarkisian came to power in 2008. However, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe gave the 2008 elections a relative clean bill of health. Now, President Sarkisian was returned on the 18th of February for a second term, and he's back in office again. But I spoke to Andrius Gokassian's wife, Anna. While he was on hunger strike, Andrius was too weak to take the conversation. At that stage, he had been on hunger strike for 25 days. So I caught up with Anna. She was speaking on Andrius Gokassian, the Armenian presidential election candidate's behalf, why he decided to go on protest, on hunger strike, and what he was hoping to get from it. Now, it is a mobile phone call that I made to Armenia a couple of weeks ago. I'm still waiting on the bill on that one. So there's a little bit of interference on it, but overall, the quality is quite good. Here we go.
Presidential election is coming up in Armenia on the 18th of February.
Yes.
Can I ask you, why is Andrius on hunger strike?
The principle is because the main leading party in Armenia, it's a criminal party, and in the past they were giving the money and to the people to receive the votes. And so the problem is that he stated that the party who have in the past such experience, this party cannot took the participation in the election process, and they cannot suggest their candidate.
Okay.
So he wrote the letter to the central committee, election committee, saying that this party have no right to present there, and they didn't satisfy his letter. And after that, he goes and now sitting on his process, you know.
Okay, and what is the name of that political party?
Republican Party.
Okay, and that's the governing party at the moment?
Yes.
And he's saying, Andrius is saying that they were bribing people to vote for them?
Yes.
At the moment, the current president of Armenia is Serge Sarkisian, is that right?
Yes, he's the leader of the Republican Party.
Okay, and he's been president since 2008?
Yes. From that time, they were giving money to the people to receive votes.
Yes. Now, I remember at the time his election was quite controversial. Is that why it was so controversial? It was controversial because people believed he was bribing people to vote for them.
The situation is reverse and repeating again.
Who exactly was he bribing? Was he bribing members of the public to vote for him?
Not him, but the people around.
Okay.
Just citizens of Armenia.
Okay, and how would they do this? Because that's a very long and a very expensive process. How would you bribe everybody to vote for you?
They are pressing through their governmental structures to bring people there. The people in Armenia are very poor, and each possibility to earn money is something mean for them.
Yeah.
So the people who are the responsible for the this or that city house, or for the people who are responsible, like they are small but villages, but the leader of this village is working under the government of this party.
Okay.
And so these small structures, they were giving the money to the people, and instead of that, they are receiving their numbers of their passports, so they can be sure that they can vote instead of them.
Okay, so what they did was they would give money to local communities for buildings or for projects, and then
sorry for my language.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. And they would support local community projects, and then in return,
to the local community.
Okay, and local people would vote for them in return.
Yes.
And what kind of projects were these that they supported?
Structures. Community structures.
Like what? What do you mean by a community structure?
For example, the chief of the community, he's a member of Republican Party.
Okay.
Or he's working like a governor to this part of the republic. And all the system of government presently in Armenia is under their control.
Okay. So he controls the local community groups, and therefore the local community votes for him.
Yes.
So it's a kind of it's a social pressure more than a financial pressure, is it?
And social pressure and financial pressure. They are using both.
Okay. So do they give local people money to vote for them?
They give money on one hand. On the other hand, they, for example, to the schools, from the directors of the school, they press the teachers that if they will not vote for the existing party, they just can lose their work.
Okay. So local teachers have been threatened that if they don't vote for Serge Sarkisian, they will lose their job.
Yes.
And how would they know if they voted for him or not?
They are taking their passport numbers, their names, before start the election.
Okay, and is it legal to check somebody's passport number like that?
No, it's illegal. That's why Andreas started with protest.
Okay, so basically they're checking their passport number against who they vote for.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So now, Andreas, is he a politician by background, or what is his background?
Graduated State University of Economics.
Okay.
And St. Petersburg University for jurisprudence.
Okay, so he's not, he's just recently got into politics, is that correct?
Yes.
And where is he now at the moment, physically, where is he now?
He is in front of Academy of Armenia.
Okay.
State Academy of Armenia.
And he's in a tent. He's camping outside.
What?
And where he is outside in a tent, is that correct?
Outside.
Yes.
Outside.
Okay. And what condition, what physical condition is he in at the moment?
He's in good condition, but of course he's weak.
Yes.
But he very cold outside. It's minus 12 or minus 15 during the night and about zero minus during the daytime.
Okay. Now, I've read here, so that's obviously very difficult for somebody who hasn't eaten in 24 days. He hasn't eaten any food. Is he taking any liquids?
Yes, he has water. He's taking water.
And that's the only thing he's taking?
Yes.
Okay. He's continuing with the hunger strike. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Before 20th of February.
Until the 20th of February?
Yes.
Okay. Why until the 20th of February?
After the election, he's waiting the announcement of who will be elected.
Okay, so it's 2 days. So, Andreas's main reason for hunger strike is corruption of the Republican Party.
Yes.
And
not only corruption, but criminal behavior.
And what other behavior? What other criminal behavior is there?
Giving the bribery is the first criminal behavior and a very important position for democratic state.
Yes.
If there is coming something like that.
Okay. And what is his chances of winning the election?
I think low because they will continue their practice coming from the previous elections. But it gives a lot of change in the minds of the people.
Okay, so you think Mr. Sarkisian will win the election?
Yes.
Yes, but Andreas is raising awareness of corruption and crime.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Changing the mind of the people.
He's changing the mind
because
of the people.
Because a lot of people do not believe that something is possible to change in this country.
Okay.
All right. And this is their chance to believe.
Okay, very good. A chance to believe. What is life like for people in Armenia? Is the standard of living, is it high or is it low in Armenia?
In terms of European countries, it's low. And there is a very big distance between the people who have money. They live very, very good.
Uh-huh.
And especially the countryside is in a very bad condition.
Okay.
And the center of the country is a little bit good because a lot of people are out of the Armenia and they are working outside and sending money to their relatives.
Okay.
Here.
And is unemployment high or low in Armenia?
Very high. Officially, they are giving the numbers for 7 to 8, but real, it's about 50% of the people are unemployed.
How many?
50% about.
50%, but the official figure is 7 or 8.
Yes.
That's a big difference.
Big, very big difference.
Why is there such a difference?
It's difficult for me to answer why, but they are just do not want to show the real situation in a country.
Okay, so it's government propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
So you believe that Mr. Sarkisian will win the election. Also, recently there was an assassination attempt on one of the other candidates, Parur Harikyan. There was an assassination.
Parur Harikyan, yes.
Yes, excuse my pronunciation. And who was responsible?
It's difficult to say now. They are looking for who was the order for this shooting.
Okay.
We don't know yet.
And what part, do you think will Turkish and Azerbaijan relations play? Are Turkish and Azerbaijan relations important in the election?
No, I think there is interrelations between these countries and present election.
Okay.
No influence.
Okay. Okay, Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Take care and all the best to Andreas.
Thank you very much.
Okay, quite an interesting interview there with Anna Gokasian about the presidential elections in Armenia. Now, since that interview, obviously was some misunderstanding with the unemployment figures. Unemployment figures in Armenia, the official figures are 15%. So I'm not sure if that was what she meant as opposed to 50, but still quite a high figure as well. The issues that she raised about the election and passport passports being checked of people electing. Now, I checked that with some other sources in Armenia and they couldn't verify that. So that's not fully supported as of yet. No, it sounds quite an extraordinary thing to happen in any case. So, but thank you very much to Anna for her time. And as well as that, thank you to Andreas as well for allowing us to speak to him himself through his wife and to speak on his behalf, and hope he's doing well now afterwards. So staying with Armenia, on a similar kind of a topic, but about the law and the role of journalists in Armenia. Now, we've got a slightly different picture, I suppose. Not a greatly different picture, but a slightly different picture when I spoke to Ara Gazarian. Both Ara Gazarian and Ashot Varelian have written a book about the life of a journalist in Armenia. It's called Violence, Intimidation and Legal Cases Against Journalists and the Media in Armenia 2012. That's the title. Violence, Intimidation and Legal Cases Against Journalists and the Media in Armenia 2012. Now, while the situation is pretty poor in many respects for journalists in Armenia, Ara did say that there have been quite a lot of improvements, so it may not be as dark as it was originally painted. The picture may not be as dark as originally painted. Anyway, I caught up with Ara during the week to find out more about what life is like for a journalist in Armenia.
Yeah, the journalism in Armenia, with the central point on defamation cases, because defamation was recently, 2 years ago, was decriminalized, and we had huge caseload to courts with civil claims, huge monetary claims against media entities. So the central point was that. The second one was the broadcasting licensing, which is a very important point for me, because there is a case on which I'm working for 10 years now, which was a television company. It was deprived of license. And we even won in the European Court of Human Rights, but the government is not executing this judgment. So this is second important point about this report. And the third word was about the physical assaults against journalists. But it's not a hot topic now in Armenia, because it's getting minimized, this number of physical assaults. The number one issue today in Armenia are the defamation lawsuits.
Against journalists.
Against journalists and media entities and companies. Yeah.
And is that driven, are those cases, defamation cases, are they led by the government or corporations or any particular group?
We have done monitoring of all cases. There are more than 50 cases. In the initial period, there are many brought from government entities and from state bodies. But now, mostly they're coming from individuals and politicians. I would say politicians and very rich people.
Okay. What's the motivation? Why are they doing it?
There are two motivations. Number one motivation is to close the entity or to press the media freedom. Number two, there's some people, there's some guys who want just to get money from the court.
Right.
Yeah. But in the last year, the last 1 year, the practice changed. The Constitutional Court issued a very important decision as a guidance. And now the courts, they have enhanced the threshold. And now it's very hard to win a defamation case in the court against journalists.
Okay.
So it's a good practice. It's a positive practice.
Right. So it's changing in favor of the journalists, or at least against people who are attacking journalists.
The general trend is, yes, it's changing. It's not yet a victory, but it's changing.
Okay. So what is life like then for a journalist in Armenia in terms of these defamation cases that you mentioned, as well as a certain amount of physical abuse? What is life exactly like for a journalist there?
Well, mostly when there's a case about physical abuse against journalists, the police, what the police does, they just do imitation. Imitation of remedies.
Like, okay, for example, what do you mean by that?
They're imitating. For example, if we have a case, an assault against journalists, and they file a police report, and the police never says, no, I'm not going to institute a criminal case. They open a criminal case, and they do some kind of investigation taking 2 or 3 months, and eventually they close down the case by saying, on the basis of lack of corpus delicti, meaning a lack of offense or lack of proofs or evidence.
Right.
if any government officer is involved or any rich people, oligarchs are involved in such cases, then this is the last scenario that usually happens. So it's, we call it imitation of legal remedies.
Okay. So they're going through the motions. They're not really doing anything.
Yeah, they or sometimes they do what we call selective justice.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. That's the basic problem here.
Okay.
They never say no. They always open a criminal case. But now they learned how to imitate with criminal prosecution, criminal procedures.
And how was it recently during the recent presidential elections? Was there more press freedom, less press freedom, or was there any difference at all?
No, there was much more press freedom, and there have been many monitoring reports. Equality, access to media for all presidential candidates. So with this presidential elections, it was a big change compared with the last presidential elections of 2008.
Okay, a change for the good.
Change to the good, yeah. Okay. Access to media was improved, equal access, and the prices for advertisements, political advertisements, they're also reasonable.
Okay, good. Now, tell us a little bit about the book. You've co-written it with another journalist in Armenia, is that right?
That's my partner in a law firm. Actually, we are a law firm.
Okay.
My partner, Ashok, so we work together, yeah.
Okay, good. And the title of the book?
The title of the book, Media Freedom in Armenia.
Okay. And the content of the book, is it pretty much what we've just spoken about what it's like for, as a journalist in Armenia? Or what else is in the content of the book?
Again, the central content is the defamation lawsuits and then broadcasting licensing competitions.
Okay.
Because in 2010, we had very important competition, which was held after the pressure from the Council of Europe. And what we said in the book was another imitation by government bodies before the Council of Europe, which was unfortunately accepted by OSCE, European institutions, as a good competition, but it was an imitation again.
Okay.
What actually happened in these competitions, under law we have six criteria in order for the regulatory body to choose the winner of a license, broadcasting license. In this last competition, one criteria, which was the financial criteria, was given absolute privilege. That's why the Council of Europe said that such competition does not ensure pluralistic media.
Okay.
Because one entity may, in its competition bid, may propose pluralistic media, but the commercial entity may win, finally may win the competition because they can offer more money.
Okay.
So absolute privilege was given to the monetary factor, and that's why we call that the broadcasting media is getting commercialized in Armenia.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a case of the corporations are getting involved, and quite possibly the corporations are, and the commercial enterprises are closing down the journalists that are, for want of a better description, non-commercial.
Yes, but also consider that in Armenia, the commerce is very much interconnected and related with state governance.
Okay.
There's a very high rate of corruption. So when we say that broadcasting media is getting commercialized, it means that it's losing its independence.
Okay.
Because behind the commercial entities, usually high government officers stand.
Okay. Okay. And do you know of any people who are behind that? Do you know that there's a direct link between the commercial operations and the political parties? Are there people who are members of the political parties, or possibly even politicians in the parties, who are also, say, directors in those corporations?
There are a couple of television companies that are owned by political parties, directly related by documents, by papers. And there are others that you will not see this connection, but still they govern the TV.
Okay, all right. So there's quite a big influence there. Now, in the recent presidential election, one of the candidates, Andrius Gokasian, he was on hunger strike, I think, for about 25 to 30 days, and he was to finish a couple of days after the election. Was that widely publicised in Armenia during the campaign?
Yes, it was widely publicised. Every day the media was full with reports about his health, about his demands, about how the government is scrutinising this hunger strike. Yeah, it was very widely publicised.
Mm. And
even now he joined... See, the movement is still going on. Now the second stage of the movement is getting on after presidential elections. The opposition is getting united.
Okay.
So Andreas Lukashen, he joined the demonstration. The media was again reporting about him, that he's recovering now after a post-hunger strike period.
Okay. And is that a big movement, the opposition movement, that Andreas will be a part of?
No, Andreas's factor is not a big factor. Other stronger opposition figures are in place. But the movement is getting on, is getting bigger and bigger now. We don't know what's going to happen next day, but yeah. Something new, a new culture. You know, one of the candidates was a guy who was Armenian, but was born and raised in the United States.
Okay.
So he has very much American culture in it, how he does his campaign,
yes.
You know, talking to people. So this attracted people.
Yes.
And so people are getting like united around him.
Okay.
And step by step, other opposition parties are getting closer to him. So we don't know what's going to happen. But yeah.
And the divide there with opposition parties in the government, is it a case of left wing and right wing, or is it something? Is there something else that divides the parties?
What you said, that exists, but. You know, Council of Europe has in many occasions has said that you cannot bring up the slogan, the winner gets everything.
Okay.
So in our country, still that culture exists when the winner must get everything. So like opposition are bad guys, you know, they're getting revenge, something like this. Right. So it's not about, it's not only about the ideology of right wing and left wing, but also... Like opposition is bad, you know. They're trying to convince people,
okay.
But we want to put it behind, you know.
Right. Okay.
Your 24-hour community station.
867-1190
Near FM.